This is for the nerds, this is for the brainiacs, this is what we deserve. Go ahead and play it back, you ain't gonna touch me, you're not gonna do nothing, you are not above me, I bet you wish you was me, I know that I know.
What is poppin', everybody? And welcome back to another special episode of the Only Friends Podcast. Well, you know, it's me and my only friends, which includes, but it's not limited to, my boy, Hunt. How are you today, Matthew Hunt?
I'm doing well, Conrad. That was a very, like, you sound like you're going to be on the radio with that intro.
We're very glad to have you in studio here today for Stretch Ed. This is going to be awesome.
Yeah, I hope so.
How's everybody else doing?
You could be on British radio with that voice. You really could. In the UK, we would call that a Radio 4 voice, because Radio 4 is the radio station that has all the people who really have that sophisticated voice going on.
Wow. It's like a borderline accidental Mark Wahlberg impersonation.
Really?
How's your mother doing?
Oh, okay.
Tell your mother for me.
I just thought a Mark Wahlberg impersonation would be like a really strong Boston accent. Like
there was a little bit of that.
Yeah. That's actually a subtle Andy Sandberg impersonating Mark Wahlberg.
Right, right, exactly.
So Conrad doing Andy Sandberg doing Mark Wahlberg here live for now, you all.
We need someone to do Conrad doing Andy Sandberg right. Doing what we need.
Well, we just did. We had the tortoise do it.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. There we go. We're adding levels. We're adding layers to this shit.
Oh, man. That's right. We're coming from downtown.
This Stretch Chat.
I'm happy to have you here today, Hunt, because all I wanted to talk about yesterday was WrestleMania, and all ended up talking about was women in poker.
Yeah, it's two very contrasting topics.
You know, both of which I think you're not an authority on, but like somebody who could reasonably carry a conversation on both.
I have much more to say when it comes to evaluating WrestleMania than I do when it comes to meaningful opinions on women in poker. Like, I'm not the guy to listen to on that, but I'm definitely the guy to listen to about WrestleMania.
So I didn't catch... If I had known I could watch it for free when I was growing up, I'll tell you the last time I watched WrestleMania. It was 2000. So what month are we in? March? Mm-hmm. It's always in the spring, right?
Yeah, March, April.
Okay, yeah. So spring of 2000, Chad Rice.
I was about to say we were at Chad Rice's house.
Chad Rice ordered it, pay-per-view. It was the night Owen Hart died.
Oh, shit. Well, that wasn't WrestleMania. That was a different event.
Oh, Was it?
That was
SummerSlam?
No. King of the Ring, I think. King of the Ring, maybe. 1998. Yeah.
Okay.
Whatever it was a pay per view event.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. That was the last pay per view I watched. I remember there being a large delay because Owen fell from the rafters. Yeah. They fucking wrestled through his blood. It, like, blood soaked ring. It was sick.
Absolutely fucked up things Vince McMahon has done. That's one of the worst.
Like, has to be.
A guy dies and everyone's like, oh, you got to just carry on with the show.
And they, like, you know, the audience witnessed the whole thing happened.
Like the super traumatic thing of a guy literally dying in front of thousands of people, and they just like carry on. You know, like it's insane. Absolutely insane.
Okay. Have you never heard the phrase "the show must go on"?
I have, but I think there's an exception for when caveats. Someone literally dies.
No, like the show must go on at all costs.
Not America, baby. What?
Well, I mean, guys, the Bills, you know, they made up for it. The guy got a concussion. He almost looked like he was going to pass away.
And he was dead for a little bit,
yeah,
I think.
The NFL made up for it.
They canceled the game.
It was not a concussion, I don't think.
No, it was
a heart thing.
A heart thing, yeah.
It was heart like, stopped.
Okay. Heart, well, yeah, it was a concussion. Same.
It was a concussion of the heart.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Same.
What Landon was going to ask is what happened to Owen Hart. I could see it all over his face.
Mm-hmm. What happened to Owen Hart?
He was doing an entrance where he was descending in a harness from the rafters. He was being like lifted down into the ring, and his harness broke, and he fell and landed on the ring
post,
the turnbuckle of the ring.
I had heard that he wasn't even harnessed in.
I don't know. I've never been able to watch the footage, so I don't know specifically.
Well, yeah,
but basically, he fell from a. It's out
feet.
There. It's out there. The footage.
I was going to say it has to be out there.
It's out there, but I've never watched it.
He
dropped from a great height onto a ring post. Basically, just I don't know what happened. It just collapsed his chest or something.
It was 50 feet.
Just died.
Fell on the turnbuckle. Allegedly, they massaged his heart in the middle of the ring. He passed away before he made it to the hospital. So the whole ring is blood soaked. I'm sorry, what?
Nobody else is hearing that.
Yes, but we are.
So I know every time, you
everyone in here. What
it
do you
sounds
want?
Sounds like Japanese porn to me.
That's it's funny exactly that what I thought it sounded
something,
like.
When something random or like foreign like goes into our headsets, like we always like bring light to it. when
you can't help
the audience could not hear it.
But you just can't help it.
You just have to ignore it.
You can't
we
help
hear
it
the weirdest fucking sounds.
Right. It's never something normal. It's never just
it was like what the fuck?
He's never Googling like, you know, the great Googly Moogly commercial or anything like that. It's always this like weird dark web shit.
Oh, stop. It's not that bad.
I mean, you know, we found out, you know, he is kind of famous for this, you know, letting his browser go a little bit
my
sometimes.
My browser history, yeah.
I did want to say it was a pay-per-view called Raw is War.
That's not a pay-per-view.
I believe.
That's the prelim to the pay-per-view.
That was what the name of Monday Night Raw used to be.
Right.
So that was their weekly show on a Monday. It was, I am
which apparently
like
Netflix bought.
Sure it was a, they did.
I think
WWE Raw is going to be on Netflix from January, I believe, next year.
Yeah,
so
I'm not positive of the Owen Hart thing, but I feel like it was SummerSlam, just because I remember it being warm outside. And
it was in May.
That would be SummerSlam.
I'm like 80% sure it was King of the Ring 1998. Not 100%,
that.
But...
I just know it was nice outside because we went outside and smashed Pat Macklin's head into a steel garbage.
Not Pat McAfee.
Yeah, I did almost say Pat McAfee.
Speaking of which,
we could have. He was only like 14 at the time.
Your boy McAfee was on commentary for WrestleMania.
Yeah.
He's really fucking
funny.
He's
incredible.
He's so good. Even my wife, who likes wrestling as well, but she doesn't like a lot of WWE stuff. She isn't really usually that interested. I had WrestleMania on. She was like, wow, this guy's really funny. She liked McAfee, and she was like, he's really adding something to this on commentary. So my wife is a McAfee fan now, thanks to WrestleMania.
That's good to hear. He talks about this all the time, and I never really gave it much credibility because I stopped watching wrestling years ago. But he'll like cut promos during his show. And when you're watching, you just assume that, you know, it's like ad lib, but also probably something that was like prep. No, this guy is just like so good.
Yeah,
he just like snaps into whatever character it is that he needs to play. I saw a highlight of this past WrestleMania. I think it was for the main event when like Undertaker came in and John Cena came in, and there was a point where I think Cena like cleared off the commentary.
The announce table when they do when they're like, okay, we're about to throw a guy through the table.
Right, yeah. You know, honestly, it really is like watching a male soap opera. Like, it's so
that's
predictable.
Exactly it is,
everything's telegraphed. But he dropped a one-liner in there that I don't remember off the top of my head, and he said it like so nonchalantly and not with a tone of seriousness, but like with a tone of no shock whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I just died. Yeah. I was like, that's so subtle, but
he's
man,
great.
He just
and
absolutely
you know what
it.
Was even funnier is they had a match where I don't remember why. Well, okay, so backstory is they have so much like sponsorship now, right?
Yeah.
Every match is like, this match is sponsored by this.
Yeah, C4, and Prime. Oh, I saw the Prime bottle.
Right.
That was ridiculous.
And one of the matches was sponsored by some new drink that is the company is like Snoop Dogg's company. Makes a drink.
Okay.
So they got Snoop Dogg on commentary for this match.
Of course.
And he's done a bunch of stuff with wrestling before. He's like, he has fun with it. But it was Snoop and Pat McAfee and Michael Cole, the other commentator, on commentary. And McAfee was just cracking weed jokes like the whole time. And it was really, really funny. The match was like
he does this on a show too. Like he's a stoner.
Yeah,
he's like an admitted stoner, and he does this on a show on ESPN all the time.
Yeah.
It was Over the Edge in 1999.
Over the Edge, of course, 1999.
Which I feel like was maybe a one-off.
It's not like a regular event
Yeah. And Owen wasn't even Owen Hart in that one. He was the Blue Blazer
or something.
Or whatever
it
was.
Yeah,
what a way to go out. You hate to see it. your alternate characters.
You're going out like in a fucking luchador costume, like like dressed up like a Mexican wrestler guy. Like, you're not even allowed to die in your own character.
Yeah, man, WWE, brutal. But the hype was real. I guess like coming full circle, it's like now it's free on Peacock.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they partnered with Peacock for...
They used to have a thing. They used to have a WWE Network, which was
right,
like their own app.
Yeah.
And they still have that outside the US, I believe. But now everything that they do in the US is on Peacock. They just like they partnered with NBC to just have all their shit on Peacock. Mm-hmm. So if you have Peacock, you can watch all their main like pay-per-views. And I think they get episodes of Raw and SmackDown like a couple weeks after they air.
Right. And that makes sense, right? Like they own USA Network also.
Yeah.
Peacock does. Okay. And, so that makes sense.
Right.
So they've been on USA.
We just got a fact checked. I'm sorry.
Go on.
Do it to our good friend Corgasm.
Yeah.
Who was yelling at me in the chat to Google it. He did it for me, and it was Over the Edge.
I hate
you so much.
He literally just said that 30 seconds ago.
What is wrong with you, man? You have headphones on. Like, it'd be funny if this were a bit, but it's not.
I think it might be a bit this time.
I can't believe he stopped the show, and I knew what was happening. It was like watching a train crash.
The amount of positive versus negative CSAs has been like 0 to 24.
Shut your face.
It's just so insane that he confidently says it's Raw is War, which anybody who's ever watched wrestling just knows that it's not. Then someone in the chat does the word for him 10 minutes after the host is in his lap fucking Googling it.
These headphones are so loud today.
Oh my
gosh. For what it's worth, Conrad, I do it all the time, but not
out loud.
Not on the show, because like when I'm off the air, I'm just in my own world. But on the show, I try to listen to what people are saying.
I was making fun of you for doing it on the boat.
It's incredible. It's like Conrad.
Exactly.
Conrad is our less aware Jesse Sylvia, if that's somehow possible. I'm the co-host. I'm the sidekick.
You're sidekick, yes.
Christ almighty, man.
You're the official sidekick.
Wait, what was it called? Over the Edge?
Over the edge. Over the top, if you want to bring it Sylvester Stallone.
You're going to throw Conrad over the edge.
Over the Edge is kind of like a...
Sent me over the edge a long fucking time ago, buddy.
You've been off the edge.
Got to say, also, it's kind of an unfortunate name for an event where a guy fell to his death.
Yeah.
That's
like,
fucked up.
Specifically, dies by falling off of something. Yeah. Like, that's unfortunate.
We're living in a simulation, man.
We really are, yeah.
Man, that kind of sucks. Gosh. Like they probably checked that harness so many times and then just like
The story about Vince McMahon has always been that every time someone is going to do something dangerous for something like that, Vince McMahon always tests it himself first. So I don't know. That's what people have said, and people not Vince himself, people other than Vince have said that he's willing to do this stuff. I don't know though, because how do you test it and then it still fucks up? Like someone's done something irresponsible somewhere, right? Like if a guy ends up dying from the fact that the harness broke or whatever, like something's gone wrong.
Was there any insurance policies on his life?
Who the hell knows? I don't know. But I have no idea, but I just know that there's a bunch of people that were like backstage performing and they were like, yeah, he died, but you got to go out and do your match now.
I'm curious if he was like, married.
Yeah, he was.
He was.
Yeah.
Interesting.
AEW, the other rival promotion to WWE now, AEW has a tournament that they do every year named after Owen Hart, and they get his wife to like present the winner at the end, like present the belt or something. So there's still a lot of like people remembering him because obviously he died young and it's very tragic and he was really popular. But it's one of the most fucked up things in terms of how the industry responded to it at the time. It was really, really messed up.
I think it's interesting to see the shift that the WWE I guess is taking now that, as best I can tell, it's clear McMahon is out.
He's done
enough egregious. He's basically become the Steve Wynn of wrestling.
It's funny, they spent the whole WrestleMania weekend just burying him. Not by actually mentioning him. You're not allowed to mention him anymore. Like,
right.
You're not allowed to say his name on air anymore. Mm. But everybody was so glowing in how much they were talking about Triple H, who's taken over from him.
Yeah.
They were all like praising him to high heaven all weekend and like just completely sucking him off about how great he is at this job, to the point where it made it very obvious that all of them were essentially just saying, yeah, Vince is gone, fuck him, we're like, we didn't like him anyway, now we like the new guy, you know. So it was a weird weekend of everybody passively trashing Vince McMahon.
Yeah, I'd be shocked, or I guess I wouldn't be that shocked, but maybe we'll see a Bret Hart return finally.
Well, there was one already.
Really?
Yeah, he.
I didn't think they ever patched things up.
Yeah, he had a match against Vince at like WrestleMania in like 2010 or something.
Oh my god!
They were both old as fuck, and it was terrible. But
yeah, of course
they did patch things up. And I guess Bret needed some money, so
that makes sense.
How it goes in wrestling.
Well, that was what I was about to say. So like, the Attitude Generation now is like becoming the executives. Like Triple H was a big part of
which is super weird. Yeah,
right. Yeah. But they all look so fucking good. Like, think about when, like, Hogan and Ric Flair and, like, you know, fucking Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Animal and Hawk. Like, when they kept making their... They kept clinging to the last second of fame. They looked like garbage.
Yeah.
The fucking Rock looks like he's 26 years old.
I if you compare, even if you compare 50, I think he's 51, The Rock.
Yeah.
If you compare him to 53-year-old Chris Jericho, who's in AEW, Jericho's in good shape for a 53-year-old. He's nothing compared to The Rock.
Right, The Rock is in good shape for a 30-year-old.
Yeah, it's literally, like, he almost looks basically the same as he did 20 years ago. And I have no idea, like, what he puts into his body to make that happen, but it's credit to him because he must work fucking hard.
Of course, like, who cares what goes in?
Yeah, of course.
You know what I mean? Like, if that's the result, seems like a positive one. He looks fantastic. I mean, The Undertaker
externally
looks pretty
good. There was a period, though. Undertaker looks okay now, but there was a period where Undertaker was really banged up. Like, there was, if you look at his, it was supposed to be his original last match in, like, 2017. It was terrible. Like, he was, like, clearly, like, 20, 30 pounds overweight. Right, like, he had, like, hip problems. He couldn't walk very well. And now that he's been retired for a while, he's, like, doing slightly better, I think.
For those tall guys, though, they're not expected to have the bodybuilder build or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you look at the guys who are 6'8", 7 foot tall, like, how do you... When you're 50 years old and you're 7 foot tall, like, how do you still stay in shape? It's got to be really difficult just to move around, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, man, Cena also looked fantastic.
Except for the bald spot.
I was about to say, should have left the hat on. Definitely should have left the hat on.
It's so surreal to me, like, because he had, like, a crew cut for, like, his whole career, mostly.
Yeah.
And now he's in Hollywood. He grew his hair out.
Right.
And the bald patch that makes him look super old is so weird to
me. So this is the last thing we're going to talk... There isn't anything else to talk about at WrestleMania, but I want to touch on Cena for a second.
Okay.
Have any of you guys seen Ricky Stenicki?
No. I've heard it's funny.
Oh, okay. So it's a free movie, I think, if you have Amazon Prime. John Cena is the lead. My best friend Danielle told me I have to watch this. Mm-hmm. It's hilarious. I'm a cheap laugh. It does not take much for me to laugh. I still, to this day, think Bridesmaid is the funniest movie ever made in the history of Hollywood, simply because Melissa McCarthy shits in the street. Like, that's good enough. It's happening. Oh, it's happening.
It happened.
And you're also still on the Friends is funny train.
Friends is phenomenal. One of the greatest shows ever. Seinfeld also. We were blessed in the 90s. But that's neither here nor there. I didn't even so much as crack a fucking smile at Ricky Stenicki. And I need to know if I'm the outlier.
What I heard.
Like,
I've not seen it. I've not heard it. I heard someone say it was funny, but that was just one random person.
Everybody I've talked to claims it's funny, but I feel like none of them have actually watched it because it's so stupid.
So here's the funny thing about Cena, The Rock, etc. The Rock is the worst actor of all the three wrestlers who've become actors. The best is Dave Bautista.
Okay.
Bautista is a legitimately really good actor.
Mm.
And my wife, who used to be in theater, worked with actors, directed plays and shit. Like, she loves his acting because he's done some really good performances.
That's Drax from Guardians of the Galaxy.
Exactly. Yeah. Cena is kind of good. Like, he's pretty funny in some stuff. And everyone thought when The Rock started, everyone was like, oh, wow, then The Rock can act. You know, The Rock is, like, decent at acting. Turns out, if you put The Rock in anything other than just, like, a big action kind of role, he can't do shit. Cena is kind of funny, but he can't do much beyond that. But Batista is the guy who can actually act, and no one expected that. Everyone thought, like, Batista was going to suck at acting, but turns out he's actually really good.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting because The Rock is the highest paid actor in the
world. Exactly. Exactly. Can't act for shit, but you just put him
in
action movies.
His movies make billions.
Yeah,
so
I mean, The Rock is like the Sylvester Stallone of this generation or the Arnold of this generation.
Yeah.
You know, it's like
I would think a lot of people would qualify them as good actors.
Arnold, no. Arnold can't act for shit. He's like, he can't do, like, what role has Arnold done where he shows his acting chops?
Kindergarten Cop was sick. Commando.
Yeah.
Done. Twins?
Kindergarten Cop was
he Commando or was Stallone Commando?
No, Commando was Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Look, who is your daddy and what does he do? Is one of the best lines. That's pretty strong.
He actually has some banger movies. Predator.
He does have some great movies.
Terminator.
Predator is one of his best, but that doesn't mean he's a great actor.
Yeah, that's fair, I guess. I don't know. I would say
Conan
the Barbarian.
I would say Stallone is a better actor because he's actually good in Rocky. Stallone has.
I was gonna say, like, I thought his role in Rocky is phenomenal.
A lot of these actors have movies where they're actually okay, but like Arnold did like fucking Jingle All the Way and shit like that.
It's
like,
Turbo Time. What do you mean?
Yeah,
like these movies are classics.
My favorite Arnold line is that "Put the cookie down" line from Jingle All the Way. Yeah, that's like, that's like the funniest Arnold line.
I mean, that is kind of the meme with putting Arnold in comedy roles is that he's still just playing the Terminator, just comedically.
But that's what I mean. Like, funny, but like, I don't imagine that they had that in mind when they cast him. You know, they weren't just like, okay, we want you to play this comedy role, but just play it like the Terminator.
Yeah, True Lies actually might have been his best role.
I haven't seen that.
I'm not a big Jamie Lee Curtis fan, but I could see like her kind of carrying that script.
That, I mean, it was good. Yeah. James Cameron, thank you, was the director of it.
Wait a minute, did you know that they made a Kindergarten Cop 2 in 2016 and it's not Arnold?
Absolutely not.
It's Dolph Lundgren. Yeah.
Wait, they're the same age.
It's Ivan Drago.
Why would you pick? So I was listening to a podcast.
I just looked up Kindergarten Cop and saw this. What the hell?
Schwarzenegger just did a podcast with the Kelsey brothers. And he said that he was actually cast to play one of the villains in Rocky. And they were insinuating, like, would you have taken Dolph's role?
Mm-hmm.
Like, who would be better? And he made two good points. Number one, Dolph Lundgren was fantastic as Ivan Drago. And number two, he's German, not Russian.
Right.
Yeah.
We were fighting the Cold War. Like, the whole undertone of the movie was political.
Yeah.
But, man, it would have been great if it was Arnold in Rocky V instead of fucking Tommy
Gunn.
Been
great. Also, the American audience doesn't care who's Russian and who's not.
That's true.
How many non-Russian people have played Russians in movies?
You could have snuck that one by the goalie so easy. We would just be like, all right, I guess that's a Russian accent.
The worst for that is The Hunt for Red October, because Sean fucking Connery plays a Russian dude.
Yeah. Right.
And he just has his Scottish accent with weird Russian twinge to it. Nobody cared. Nobody noticed.
Right. Put the accent down.
Nice.
The person who should play every single foreign role from now until the end of time is John Malkovich.
Oh, like, he's incredible.
I actually don't even know what his true voice sounds like.
It's just a normal, like, middle-aged American accent.
I feel like he's played an accent in every role that he's taken on. And I was just like, what does this guy actually sound like?
He's the anti-Arnold, where Arnold only has one voice.
Right.
Malkovich doesn't even have his own voice.
Right.
He just has every other voice.
Yeah, that's actually very true. All right, let's get to a couple news and notes that we have to discuss. Big shout-out to Rob Kuhn. He agreed to a buyout today to stop fasting. This was day 16, I believe. Looks like he's going to get a buyout of $25,000.
You say congratulations to him?
Well, he chose to buy out.
Yeah.
He made money.
He won.
Oh, he won.
He won $25,000.
Yeah.
He bet $3,000 to win 60 and then took $25,000.
Yeah. Gotcha. I thought you meant he paid $25,000.
Basically, was just paying it back because, you know,
the hardest time
of the challenge, mm-hmm. they let him out.
Okay, well, I have thoughts.
Go on.
I don't understand why these challenges keep ending early if the purpose of the bet is to prove that the person can't do the thing.
They didn't prove anything.
It didn't prove anything.
No.
I mean, like, look, don't get me wrong. He did a 16-day fucking water fest. That is hard.
That is a lot.
That is hard. And if the original bet were, I bet you can't go 16 days without food, we would all be like, bro, you fucking did it.
How much do you think
being able to drink coffee helped?
A lot. Fucking
like that 2-hour window.
Mm-hmm. A lot. I survived off pre-workout mm-hmm. when I did mine.
Because you just don't have an appetite as much, right?
It's an appetite suppressant. It also like keeps you from crashing. Because, you know, at the end of the day, like you're deep into ketosis.
Yeah, it's a stimulant, so it's just gonna just keep going.
Right. Well, so there are a couple things at play here. Like when you go that deep into ketosis, you're really sharp. At least for some period of time, mentally.
You're locked in.
But physically, you know, you start to drain because you don't have much glycogen in your stores. And you don't want to break down too much muscle. So, like, being a little bit immobilized, I guess, is helpful for that. But, yeah, the stimulant on top of the fact that you're in ketosis, like, you really feel like you're a superhero.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got to be a pretty good feeling. It's also an appetite suppressant. So I'm sure that was really helpful.
How much would he have won if he would have...
$60,000.
So yeah. He got 40% or whatever.
So basically, we saw two bets in the past 3 months. Yeah. And both of them, the person probably, you know, there's a good chance that person would not have made it. And I would say it's probably over, you know.
I told Deeb this.
50%.
Yeah, I told Deeb this, and I still hold to this.
Sticking to
I don't think he would have made the, what was it, 17.5% or 18%?
Yeah.
I don't think he would have made it in the time allotted. I think he would have got close.
Yeah, I was going to say, even so, it might have just been a close sweat.
Yeah, I think he would have got close, but I don't think he would have made it, and I don't think Rob would have made 30 days.
Yeah, it's like, you're not going to blow this out by any
means. I mean, obviously, Sean thought he was going to if he agreed to the buyout.
Yeah, but he's also getting a pretty good price. He's paying less than half.
No,
and
right.
You also don't even know, like, he's 14 more days left.
Paying less than half, and he was already halfway
over,
done.
Like, slightly over halfway.
Yeah. Sounds like a just pay spot.
Which was the exact opposite of Perkins. I don't think, like... Like, Sean wasn't really 80%.
What was,
like,
that buyout for?
800 or 850.
How did I miss that?
You were probably just zoned out like I usually do.
Yeah, you're probably Googling when Owen Hart died.
It was over the edge, by the way.
Oh, 1999?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I remember
guys,
that one.
Guys, yeah. By the way.
Yeah.
This is a new pod meme.
Arnold is not German.
He's Austrian, yeah.
Same thing.
Right.
It's like, again, yeah. Americans, who in this country knows the difference between Austria and Germany?
You know, I appreciate the fact that nobody in the chat fucking corrected or anything. I appreciated that.
I mean,
they're all Americans.
It's all Americans.
You know what? I'm going to give him a one for the Conrad interruption. That was a good one.
They speak, mm-hmm. they speak the same language, is that right?
They do.
Okay,
yeah.
Same thing. It's like Canada and the United States.
What the fuck did he just say?
Him?
You can't even go to Canada if you got a DUI.
What on earth does that have to do with anything?
What do you mean? How is it the same?
Try telling Austrians that Austria and Germany are the same.
Well,
let's see how that goes.
Germany has a bit of a smudge on it, man. I don't know if you're aware. Maybe they want to distance themselves from that.
Well, fun fact, Hitler was Austrian. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so maybe they. That's maybe partly, it's the other way
that's
around.
That's partly why maybe, you shouldn't mix the two up.
Maybe Germans want to distance themselves from Austria.
We can play a game of, like, Fedor's crew. You know, German or Austrian? Ready? Mario Mosbach.
Austrian.
Austrian.
German.
You're right. He's wrong.
the opposite of whatever Conrad thinks.
Nice. All right. Since everyone's interrupting, it wasn't Melissa McCarthy that took a shit in the middle of the
I knew that, too. No, I knew that, too, but I didn't want to correct him.
Why? That's fine.
It was...
Fuck your shit.
It was the
girl from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, the one
girl from Saturday Night Live.
It's the main character.
Kristen Wiig.
Oh, Kristen Wiig?
No.
The one that was getting married.
She was a little darker skinned.
Oh, Maya Rudolph.
Maya Rudolph. Thank you.
She was the one who shit in the...
Yeah.
I have never seen that
Melissa
movie.
McCarthy shit somewhere for
in
sure.
In the sink.
Oh, okay.
No, she puked in. Yeah, she puked in.
No, I don't think it was that's puke.
Right, yeah.
I think it was shit.
That movie sounds like the least funny movie I've ever heard.
Bro,
in my
you have
life.
No idea.
It's are you great. 8 years old? Are it you is, literally no. 8 years old?
Yes, that's what I was saying.
It is nonstop laughter. I mean, you can't get 30 seconds to breathe.
It sounds like it would be non-stop laughter.
It's not all poop jokes.
Also, do you think you
might. It's a lot of poop jokes.
I didn't say it. I said.
Well, you're right. When they lay off the poop jokes, they go to sex jokes.
Yeah.
Well, also, do you think...
It's a dude movie written by girls.
Do you think the rippity-dippity that John Cena's in...
I'm sorry, the what?
The rippity-dippity.
Ricky Stenicki?
Ricky Stenicki.
Yeah, that one. Do you think that you would like it if it wasn't Danielle that...
No.
Told you about it?
Oh, No. I was excited to watch it.
Rippity-dippity.
Oh, my God. Wait,
there it is. There it is. See? I told you. She shit in sink.
Right.
You did not say that.
It feels like fire.
Look, Hunt's smiling. He's smiling.
How could you
I'm smiling. I'm smiling at you guys, you fucking morons.
No, I was excited to watch it when Danielle recommended it. I'm
smiling at your taste in comedy.
Comedy of our generation right there. Yeah,
comedy of your country.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I have the privilege as a Brit of looking down on American comedy.
Right.
Brit humor isn't even good.
Their comedy is sophisticated, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
Mr. Bean?
I mean, we really? At least have to be able to tell ourselves that.
we can't just shit in the fucking street.
You've got to give us something to be proud of, all right? We are a very, very terrible country at most things.
But
comedy is something we're not that
Mr.
bad at.
Mr. Bean.
I only really know Ricky Gervais to be a great British comedy.
Oh, fuck
comedian.
Him. I hate Ricky Gervais so much.
I actually think he's hilarious.
I also think
he's a good actor.
I think he started out funny, and as soon as he got popular, he got way worse. He got way less funny because he started just saying everything for shock value. Everything was just like the most controversial thing he could possibly say.
Yeah, I think I like that.
Yeah, see, that like in the UK, that doesn't get you very far. Because there's a bunch of comedians that are actually innovative and saying stuff that's like new, and you haven't really heard this kind of humor before. And that's what he started out as. But then he just, as soon as he got famous...
Well, John Oliver.
That's the funny thing is John Oliver is not very big in the UK. John Oliver is not.
Okay, so the only British comedians I find funny are the ones that you guys disown.
Well, it's because what happens is they get big in the UK, and then as soon as they get big enough in the UK that they hit like critical mass, they start trying to like conquer America. You know, they go to the States and try to get big over there.
Where the real money is.
Yeah, exactly. Because you can only make so much money being big.
Okay, so I can't even ask you for references because they're all people I've never heard of.
Well, honestly, I've been living here long enough that I don't even know who's like the up and coming comedians now, you know. So like all the British comedians that I used to watch when, you know, like TV shows that were there when I was back in the UK, most of them are either, you know, they've tried and failed to get popular in the US or they have already become popular in the US.
We can all agree Mr. Bean is terrible, right?
Mr. Bean is great. Mr. Bean is like, first of all, it's like 30 years old.
And it's so
like,
fucking hilarious.
I mean, it definitely has its moments, but I do not know who made that show, because like who created that show, because it is a weird concept.
Mr. Bean is the British equivalent to Eric Andre. It's just...
No, Eric Andre's cool.
No, he's not.
Mr. Bean's the guy that doesn't talk and just runs around places, right?
Right.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
But he just like does things that are disruptive and like very cringe comedy.
What I will say though about Mr. Bean is the guy who plays Mr. Bean, Rowan Atkinson, is an absolute legend. He is one of the most legendary comedic actors in all of the UK.
I truly didn't know he had a real name.
You have
I thought it was Mr. Bean.
You have to be a legend to fucking play that role.
I thought his last name was just Bean.
His first name was Mr.
To get that off, you have to be a legend.
He is a legend. And Mr. Bean was partially what made him a legend.
Yeah.
All right. Mr. Bean.
We've run the gamut. All right, let's I guess get into a little bit of Strat Chat,
shall we?
Yeah. I guess I can preface this with I don't like this brand of poker anymore.
Well, but once you move down to the 1-2 streets, you're just going to be forced to play
it. I used to really enjoy this brand of poker, and I think for a period of time, it almost was my identity to a certain degree. Like, I played a lot of quote unquote hood poker, you know, doing a lot of like cold calling, a lot of things that forced multi-way action. And when
hood flatting.
Yeah, a lot of hood flatting. We love hood flats. And I think that, you know, there was a reason for that. If people are bad and you get a bunch of them together in a pot, it stands to reason that benefits you in some sort of capacity if you know what's going on. And then I think like when theory started to become a little bit more popular and I dug my feet or I guess I dug in a little bit more and studied, I realized everything that is meant to be understood about this game very quickly breaks under the stress of multi-way pots, especially when there are glaring imbalances at the root node, right? So the big thing about heads-up pots are that no matter how awful your opposition is, they can't be that far out of construction for what the situation calls for, right? So if you open under the gun and someone incredibly terrible flats middle position and you go heads up, at most they're going to have a button flat range, right? Like maybe like a big, all right, at worst they'll have a big blind flat range, which seemed pretty egregious. But the point is, like, you can find a theoretical range to attribute to them, right? They're never going to be so wide that you're just like, oh, well, for fuck's sake. I'm against like 80% of hands
here. Guapo and I played some 1-2 at the Hard Rock Seminole. We were waiting for our flight after the cruise, and there was a gentleman who was playing literally 100% of hands.
Right, and the thing with that, where I was going with this, is that will now encourage more multi-way action.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right, so I'm saying, like, when pots go heads up, it's very unlikely your opposition has a range that's so wide it doesn't fit into a normal position.
Yeah.
Right? Because the wider a person flats, either the more three betting or the more flatting behind will start to occur, right? So generally speaking, if pots make their way to being heads up, even if it's not your position versus the big blind, the person that you're up against is going to have some level of construction, even if it's so wide that we're saying his level of construction is a big blind defense, right? Once it starts to go multi-way, oh baby, all bets are off.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen the most egregious shit just in 1 week on a boat playing 501k where people don't three bet.
Getting 5-1, I got a call.
I saw hands that wouldn't want to put money in the middle if you fucking spotted them a rebate. And then I saw other hands that never, never want to call. Just want to put their entire stack in the middle. I saw somebody as the fourth caller with queens. It's like, how? How did you know that the big blind was going to have jacks here? Right. How did you know this, man? And then how often does the big blind not have jacks here? And we don't get to see that you fucking were the third caller with queens.
Right.
Because you either pick it up post or it comes ace king high and you just casually fold to a C bet. So I don't know what to do anymore.
You're tilted by all the multiple.
There was a spot where I opened kings under the gun and the entire table called, and I looked to my right at Isha and I go, I hate it here.
See, this is funny because the way your policy on multiway or your approach to multiway is evolving is the exact opposite of mine. I love multiway because I have been studying it. I'm in the middle of making a course about multiway, and I'm using Rocket Solver to run a whole bunch of sims for like weird spots like six-handed and shit like that. And I am super interested in multiway because A, everyone sucks at it, and B, there are so many more variables that mean that you have like strategies that don't normally exist that start to come up, right? So you get weird concepts emerging, like you know, you'll bet in a certain spot, and then when player A calls, now your turn strategy looks like this, but when player C calls, your turn strategy looks totally different. And it completely transforms what we normally would look at as our sort of standardized strategies in a lot of spots. So I am personally becoming like super excited about playing more multiway, and I'm super happy to force people to do it in tournaments because everyone sucks at it.
You know, it's very strange because I greatly enjoy playing bomb pods, and that's the most extreme version of it.
It is.
But yeah. I think
it's different because it's forcing everybody to play their worst hands.
I think that's the common theme here is that I don't care how many players see a flop if I can range them.
Yes.
Like, I feel like so much of my underlying skill set is being able to range my opposition.
See, it's interesting that you look at it that way because the way I've always responded to that when students would come and say, like, well, how am I supposed to range somebody when, you know, they're really wide is that saying that they're really wide is ranging them, right? In that you're saying like, well, they naturally, if they have 40% of the deck here, that is a wide and weak range, which on any given board texture is going to include a lot of trashy hands. And you don't need to know much more than that. So that's the way I look at it.
On flop, that's true. But I think on later streets, that becomes very problematic.
Like, I see what you mean.
It's very difficult for me to understand. Like, in a heads-up spot at any formation, I can understand the concentration of flushes versus non-flush hands my opponent's going to have when the flush card fills.
Right.
I have a very difficult time having vision over that when I have no idea where the boundary is for their suited hands.
Mm. Or when the fourth caller just calls with queens.
Right.
Yeah. No, I see what you mean. I see how it does. It certainly adds ambiguity to later streets in a lot of spots.
And also just having to add certain strong hands back into their range where you would otherwise be able to easily eliminate. It's like it comes queen 7-3. You're like, okay, nobody has two pair here and nobody has top set. And then you like see hands like 7-3 and top set of queens. It's like, well, God damn it. They also have a lot more nothing collectively, but I'm up against a higher concentration of made hands. And it becomes tricky because so much of your value range is driven by single pairs, right? It's just about having the ace queen advantage or the kings, the ace advantage over the collective field. But it's very hard. And I know this is a big problem for the audience. It's very hard not to just fall back on your heels and turn those hands into your bluff catchers, which feels like a big problem to our strategy overall.
Yeah, I think the thing that people tend to struggle with a lot with multiway is simply the fact that you win the pot much less often.
Sure.
Right? So you start to feel like, well, I'm losing all these pots. How could I possibly be still making money when all these players are in the hand?
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I've discovered from running a lot of multiway sims that's really interesting is that what tends to happen with these spots is that there are a lot of board textures where your EV becomes way lower than what it would be if it was heads up.
Yep.
Simply because your range is more weighted towards being distributed in the, you know, the high cards being distributed in strong preflop hands. But you then get to situations where when the board texture does come out favorably for you, you make so much money that it compensates all those other spots.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have situations where, if, for example, I'm looking at like some six-way pots where we're the opener, we make it three bigs and five people call. And then you get to the flop and there's a lot of board textures where in an 18 big blind pot, your EV is less than 300 big blinds per 100. So you're making less than three big blinds from that 18 big blinds.
Mm-hmm.
There's not that many, but there are some. And then on the flip side, there are a couple of textures, like the very most favorable ones. Like if you look at like the ace, king, deuce, rainbow, that texture, now we're winning 900 bigs per 100. We're winning half of that 18 big blind pot because everybody else is so wide and we are so dense to strong hands. And that's just one example from an arbitrary set of ranges that I ran it with.
Right.
But I thought it was really interesting to see how big the scope of variation was in what the player with the strongest range's EV would be. Like to go from we're winning two big blinds out of 18 on the worst boards to now we're winning half the pot in a six-way pot on the best boards. It's really interesting.
I mean, like multi-way is just so broken where the computing power necessary to even mm-hmm. have an accurate solve is very difficult.
It's hard.
Like
yeah.
looking at like a Wiz database, and it's not like a shot at the Wiz, but like it only has up to four callers versus mm-hmm. In a spot, like versus open. It goes like open, call, like in this spot, like I just put 100 big blinds, doesn't really matter. Under the gun opens, under the gun one has calls, low jack doesn't have calls anymore, because
mm-hmm.
the sim's going to take many years to run to right. get to some reasonable amount of accuracy.
Yeah.
So you're just kind of like making some adjustments, and then it goes like, let's say under the gun calls, under the gun one calls, the cutoff calls, and now I'm at the button, and the button doesn't play calls.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's not because it won't play calls, but because you're not going to get an answer for it.
Right, and then you have the added variable that as every range is dependent on the ranges that come before it to some degree. So.
Yeah.
When you're running a sim where you have, if you allow six players to call, the frequency that each of those individual players calls is going to be quite low. And even if there is a calling range, by the time you get to the point where the sim is running iterations of what the sixth player's calling range is supposed to be, it's such a low number of iterations that the accuracy that you get over that specific range is much lower. So you would have to do something like what you can do with HRC, where you specifically run that portion of the tree to a very high resolution so that you can be confident that the sim is actually going to run enough iterations to get an accurate range. But even then, if you were to lock one of the previous ranges and you have it so that one player involved in the hand has a range that's way wider than what it's supposed to be, it throws everything off because now the equity of hands changes. You get a whole bunch of different variables in there. And what I've found so far is that even in situations where you've got, you know, four or five players going to a flop in a circumstance where the solver would say, well, you should never have a calling range in this spot. You should play three bet or fold. If everybody is punting by putting money in the pot way too wide, the solver starts to say, well, maybe we can call because there's a bunch of trashy hands in the pot that shouldn't be in there.
It is interesting to think that like maybe in, you know, 2, 3, 5 years from now, because the solves are going to get so much faster and mm-hmm. stronger and just the way technology moves, that we are going to start seeing these solves in multi-way spots, and it's going to change the game, right? Because mm-hmm. like now all of a sudden where you just think, well, I have no flats here. Now you do have flats, and now you
yep.
somebody else has flats, and now you just are seeing multi-way flops like way more common.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the direction we're headed, and I like that direction personally because I think there's so much more complexity to mm-hmm. it that favors players who understand the game in a theoretical way compared to players who just brute force their way through heads up pots. Like if you can be like kind of decent at this game just by understanding that in heads up pots you have to bluff a lot, but it's a lot harder to be decent if you play multi-way and you don't understand things like sizings and you don't understand different positions and how it affects your frequencies and all sorts of stuff like that. So I personally love multi-way, and I'm getting more and more into it the more I work on this course.
I think one of the biggest challenges that everybody's going to face is, again, since the majority of your strategy is driven by your one pair type of holdings and the EV for those are just generally going to go down, when you're multi-way, there becomes this weird, and like this is where we get into like this whole notion of just pay, where it's like the reason I promote that so heavily is so that people don't play aces so defensively.
Right.
Right. Like, you don't want to get in a habit where you just stop value betting, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you only have like two pair plus anytime that you put any money into the pot actively. I think that the reason why heads up is so attractive is because it become there's like a clear template for how you're supposed to approach these spots and if and when overpairs actually can begin to fold, right? And generally it takes a lot of texture change in order for an overpair to get worth so little that it becomes indifferent versus a bet.
Mm-hmm.
That often will require like straight cards falling, flush cards falling, whatever. But on dry textures where you hold an overpair, like come hell or high water, you generally stack off as long as you're not putting in like multiple bets on a single street.
Mm-hmm.
And multi-way, you just like can't do that. Like you actually are punting if you're the only one that's getting stacked with aces in a single raised five-way pot, and everybody else in your pool is like finding ways to get away here. It becomes very tricky because like you're really towing a fine line between what's theoretical and then what's like heavily exploitable.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that to be like the frustrating part. It's not from the redlining side. I can find my bluffs. That's easy. It's funny. Multi-way, your bluffs are actually so much more clear than your value because the equity of a bluff doesn't change based off the number of opponents all that much. If you have a gut shot, it's a gut shot to the nuts. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right? Just really doesn't matter. Like right, you may have fewer outs left.
You hit one of your four cards or you don't.
Yeah,
you
know? Exactly. Right. Precisely, right? And the blocking power that you'll have over the texture, it's going to reduce some of their calls in some sort of capacity as a collective, but like whatever, they're going to continue with what they continue with. Mm-hmm. But when you have aces and it's just a board, it's like, well, every board has sets and no one's folding pairs. So, like, collectively, the ranges are going to be more dense to sets than they would be in a heads-up pot, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody has, like, broadways. So, like, collectively, they're all going to have more top pairs, but they're also really sensitive to facing aggression. So, like, top pair just folds at a much higher frequency versus any level of aggression in multi-way pots than it does in heads-up pots. And I think this becomes, like, the difficulty in navigating these scenarios is how do we manipulate the field to pay us when we're value betting without us over investing in portions of our range that are subject to be drawing dead to the strongest portions of their range.
Yeah. And a lot of it's funny because based on the sims that I've been running, a lot of time the answer just is like, you just bet 10, B10.
Yeah.
You know, just small, bet 10%
small
pot.
Sizes, yeah.
Like there's the, I don't want to, you know, spoil the course, but like the sims that I'm running, I with these six way sims I ran, I've almost finished running a full 184 flop subset of this specific six way configuration, SPR of like 5.5 basically, and by far the dominant strategies with the preflop raiser being the third of six players to act, it's checking like 70%, it's B10 like 20-25%, and then there's like a small sliver of 5-10% of B33, 3E, and then a tiny bit on like one or two flops of 2E, where it just tries to, you know, get the money now with certain hands.
Yeah.
But basically the bulk of the strategy, like you say, is you don't put a lot of money in. However, there's a lot of really interesting spots where it goes like you B10 flop with a bunch of hands, then, you know, you get called in two spots, you B33 turn, you get called in one spot, and now your head's up on the river and you get the bomb, right?
Right, right.
Or,
yeah,
like, you B10 flop, you get called in one spot, but depending on who it is, if they have a really condensed range, there's going to be some spots where, like, turn comes one card, you just can never bet anything, turn comes another card, they get absolutely wrecked, then you can bet your entire range.
Right.
So there's so many weird divergences based on board texture and things like that, that this is why it becomes really interesting.
That resonates to me
because
you start
to see like weird divergences.
Yeah, you know? That resonates with me because that's my approach to bomb pots.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. You try to clear the field with a small bet, and then based off their positioning and the actions that they could have taken up until this point, you're able to actually narrow in on their range, because the biggest thing about bomb pots is people won't slow play.
Yeah.
So like if you're third to act in a bomb pot and you B10 and you know you get one fold and then a call, that's almost never a strong hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's like one pair or worse almost exclusively, because there isn't enough aggression that takes place by the field behind him.
Yeah.
Right? There aren't enough people, and when there is, it's just a trap. So like you don't want to trap a trap, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Like you raising here is not going to make the previous guy who is trapping suddenly fold. He's just going to put in more money. So like you're incentivized, right?
Right.
So once that happens, and now let's say you go heads up, or one of the early checkers also calls. It's like, well, you are very much against a one pair holding and draws at a really really high frequency. So when bricks roll off, you just get to polarize,
mm-hmm.
And. You know, that all makes a ton of sense, but it's also a lot easier because everybody's playing 100% of hands.
Yeah.
Right? It's when they have that choice pre-flop.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can trap a little bit more versus the B10 because it's just going to go heads up to the turn a lot.
Yeah.
So it is interesting to me. It does sound like this rocket solver would be like pretty fascinating to build a bomb pot course off of.
I've been, you know what though? I've been trying to, so what I've been doing for some of the sims for the course is running shorthanded bomb pots as a baseline,
mm-hmm.
or how certain factors like SPR and position and things like that are affecting the sims. As soon as I got to trying to run a bomb pot that was more than five ways, even for 3-4-5 way bomb pots, I had to keep the SPR relatively low and keep the game tree fairly simple with each player only having one size,
mm-hmm.
and like a 30% size, not like a B10 size.
Okay.
And then as soon as you get to like six ways and beyond bomb pots, like I have 64 gigs of RAM in my computer and my computer can't handle a tree for a six way bomb pot. So, I mean, I don't know how much better than mine your computer is. I know it's better, but I think you would need a lot of RAM to build a tree for a full nine-way bomb pot.
That's fair.
Even if you simplified the tree quite a lot. And I think if we start thinking about like a nine-way bomb pot where players have tiny bet size options and multiple sizes, I think you'd honestly be looking at like 1 terabyte of RAM you'd probably need. Yeah. So yeah. Like I still think we're a long way away from any solver existing that can actually solve nine-way bomb pots in a high degree of complexity, but we can figure out some principles from these shorthanded spots. I could run a bunch of three-handed bomb pots really easily with a fairly simple game tree. So that's kind of what I started with. And
yeah,
hopefully at some point in future, we'll be able to go further with it.
Yeah, you could probably pull some principles out of that. I do notice that like three-handed bomb pots are very simple in nature to kind of like real-time solve.
Yeah, they actually are surprisingly... Like it's surprisingly straightforward three-handed bomb pots. At least if you're keeping the tree, you know, relatively like manageable and the SPR is not too high.
Yeah, and I'm even like just saying like brain solving. Like,
right. Yeah.
It's very easy to kind of figure out how three 100% ranges are supposed to act in that particular formation. Whereas like nine-handed, you're lost.
Yeah, because you start to get to a point where you don't know where the boundary is, where a certain hand is pretty strong three-handed, four-handed, etc. But how weak does a certain hand get when you're eight-handed, nine-handed? Right. You know, like, at what point are you starting to, like, you flop trips and you're like, well, this isn't very good.
You know,
like, do you still think a trips is good at nine-handed, or are you only comfortable flopping trips when it's five-handed or lower? Like, it's really hard to know.
You just can't really
easily figure it out.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right, well, I guess we have an example of a multi-way spot. Is that accurate?
Kinda.
Okay. It is a multi-way spot.
It is a multi-way spot.
It's a hand. Okay.
It's not, I think, a great example of a spot that has the level of complexity that we're kind of talking about, because it's just raise, three bet, and two cold calls, and then you go to the flop, super low SPR. So that is one type of spot that does come up, and I've certainly spoken with students of mine who have been struggling with situations like that. But when you're at a low SPR going to the flop, it does get a lot simpler because you just follow your equity. You know, you eventually just get to a point where your hand is too good to ever fold, and you don't benefit a ton from you know playing multiple streets when the SPR is going to be so low that you know you barely even benefit from it at all. So I think it's a spot that we can talk about for sure, but I don't know if it fits a lot of what we've just been talking about.
Okay, that's fair. What do you got?
Okay, we got a submission from JP Poker. They're playing 2-5 and with a $10 straddle. Obviously, the replayer is not going to show the straddle because it wouldn't do that. But so what happens is there's a straddle from seat 4, and under the gun then raises to 30. And our hero is in the low jack with a king of spades, king of diamonds. He 3-bets to 95. There are 1,100 effective. And it folds to the small blind, who flats the 3-bet, hood flat. And then, yeah, big blind, got to come along. Here we go.
Yeah.
Calls. The straddler folds, and now the original raiser folds as well. And we get a flop of 9 of clubs, 6 of spades, 3 of spades. And the small blind decides to just lead out for 2/3 pot.
Okay.
So 200 into 330-ish. Big blind folds, and we decide to just call. And the turn is a 7 of spades, and small blind rips all in, and we call and win the hand with queens. Now you're wondering, like, this hand.
He had queens. He had queens.
Yeah. So we win the hand against queens.
Yeah.
And you're probably wondering, like, okay, this is pretty straightforward. What is going on here? Well, Our hero was highly considering folding the flop. Folding the turn.
Okay. I'm still wondering what's going on here.
Yeah, so they said the small blind snap jams, !! Hero, bunch of question marks. And then it said, what is going on here? I beat queen, jack. Could I just be drawing dead?
No.
Have we taught you nothing? Just pay.
The answer is, like, you can't rule out the fact that you're drawing dead, but it's so unlikely.
Right.
Because you have the king of spades, like, you just can't fold.
It's really, really, really hard to jam the nut flush there.
Yeah.
And expect to get paid.
That's what I mean. It's also hard to lead on flop with the nut flush draw. Like, what are we doing?
Unless you're just trying, and it's hard to flat pre.
Yeah, you're trying to lead, get it in.
It's
not hard. You just click call.
Well, that's true.
Wow.
Yeah, JP said, I probably would have leaned towards a fold without the king of spades.
Well, that's a very different equation.
Yeah.
Right. But, I mean, I still don't know.
I would never fold kings, period.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But I would also raise flop more
I would never be just calling flop.
If we go back to pre-flop, obviously, I think what he did was standard, right? So you have a straddle, under the gun, opens. We have a clear 3-bet with our hand. Now when you get to the villain in the small blind with queens, and you already have a lot of people's left to act. You have the big blind, the straddle, the original opener, and now the 3-better. And you have queens. What do we think about his flat there?
Terrible.
Right. So, like, you can't really, like,
I think if you're going to have flats, it's important to have queens because, like, you want to be able to backjam whenever under the gun, tries to pick the pot up with ace queens.
But I mean, we shouldn't have flats.
Right.
There. No. Yeah. Of course. I don't think the problem is that you're investing too much money pre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what makes post-flop so simple here for kings, is the SPR is only 3.
Wizard straddle ranges are pretty sick here, actually.
Do you think Heath is worried, like, when he's considering folding the turn, is it, like, because, well, he said queen, does he have queens or jacks? But maybe he thinks that, like, those hands are just 4-bet, so, like, why? Like, I don't beat enough.
I mean,
are the hands that I beat, but they shouldn't exist.
Well, then the problem is nothing else should exist either.
Right.
Right. Like, that's the thing here. It's not like queens or jacks should 4-bet, but some other hands should cold call.
Like nines or
right.
sevens.
Nothing should cold call
or
here.
Sixes or threes that could have flopped the set.
So you end up in a situation where when someone has a range in a spot where a range shouldn't exist, you now are forced to figure out, like, what mistake are they making? Are they making the mistake of, are they making the mistake of, like, they have ace king off and they just flat for no reason, or they have just any pair and they can't fold it, they don't want to fold pairs? Like, what mistake are they making? Because this is clearly a mistake.
I also just don't think at this SPR, this isn't what I was talking about. Like, these aren't spots where you are concerned about stacking off with an overpair,
right?
Like, you're not investing too much money if you just run into a set almost always here. It's only 3 SPR, and you need hands to stack off with. If not kings, then what? You know what I mean? Like, the bottom for your stack off range here can't be sets.
Right. There always has to be a slightly reluctant or slightly uncomfortable call-off range, right? Right. There has to be a call-off range that isn't super excited to call off. And we're not, like, massively excited here. Like, we don't have the nuts, but we have a hand that's definitely in that region of, like, well, it's a pretty good hand. Like, it's really tough to call. And if we start folding this hand, we're literally saying we're never calling without two pair plus. And since we can't really ever have a set because we three bet pre against under the gun, we're saying we can literally only call with a flush.
I don't know about you guys, but I'm pretty excited here.
Well, yeah,
I'm pretty fucking happy.
Well, what I mean is, like, we're not in a position where we can be so confident that we just almost never lose, right?
Occasionally
they just have aces somehow, yeah, or occasionally they have nines or whatever, right? Like, yeah, but course. we're never even thinking about folding here. But the basically, I guess what I mean is that we are always going to have some kind of a range that doesn't beat all of their value, right? We can't only stack off with the hands that beat their value, because that's such a narrow range in any spot that we can never have enough of those hands.
Your threshold needs to include something that makes you shake.
Yeah, like, tens and jacks don't feel great here, but, like, right, yeah, also, how are we ever folding tens or jacks? It seems crazy.
Like, I think jacks, no spade kind of feels a bit weird, because we don't have the straight draw. We don't have a spade. So, like, I could maybe see finding a fold with, like, red jacks here.
I feel like, you know, JP, our hero here, I think if he has tens, he's just going to fold. But, like, if he's considering folding the kings, right?
Well, you can't fold tens because you have a straight draw.
Right.
So, like, that, I mean, that doesn't mean that much.
But he would have mucked the tens.
Yeah. Yeah. But then tens shouldn't.
I mean, I can't really speak for him, but it seems that way, the way he was.
Yeah, you know, I imagine so. But, like, tens isn't pure three bet pre anyway. Even jacks, like, shouldn't pure three bet pre in this formation regardless. So, like, when you have that little additional bit of equity, like when you have a spade or when you have a straight draw as well, you just shouldn't fold, because you're still live against some of his value. Like, when you're still live against a set of nines or something, if you have tens, you're still live against queens here, especially if you have a spade. I don't think you should fold. But as soon as you get to a point where you are needing them to specifically either have value that you're way ahead of or a bluff in order for you to be in good shape, like when you do have red jacks here, you need them to have tens, or you need them to have, like, ace king with the ace of spades somehow. That becomes a little bit dicier, but if you have queens, they can have jacks. Like, that's where the point. I think the point of never folding here for me is queens. Red jacks I might sometimes think about, but I'd probably just be all in on flop anyway. Yeah. So it wouldn't even matter.
Yeah. Does small blind have, I'm sorry, you said small blind shouldn't be four betting jacks and tens.
They shouldn't be cold calling. They probably should be four betting.
They do four bet.
They four bet. Yeah.
Jacks pure, tens mixed folds.
Okay.
Queens actually just jam small blind.
Yeah,
like
I was going to say jam was probably the option with queens and ace king.
Queens, ace king, kings, like 20%.
Yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, I wasn't going to say those hands should fold. I was just specifically, they shouldn't really cold call them.
My fear is what this range looks like from the small blind that cold calls and then leads. Mm-hmm. So what's the worst value hand I think exists? Probably tens, right? Does ace king off with a spade exist? Probably not.
Well, you know? I mean, if... In real life, that should exist.
Yeah.
In real life, at the 2-5 table, that should exist.
I don't think Ace King just leads, though.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I don't know. I understand. The desire to lead is to protect your range. But, like, you're going to face a C-bet. Ace King doesn't really want to face a C-bet.
Well, the desire to lead is to protect your hand, right? But Ace King doesn't need protection. And you don't think about,
doesn't
want to
check
with.
Fold, is my point.
I don't think it just takes a lead strat, though.
I don't know.
You know? So, but, like, I guess that's
not something we're going to see a lot, but we will see it once in a blue fucking moon.
But I guess this is where the issue comes in when it, like, I think about even flop flat is, like, the bluff that exists is very rare, if not like non-existent, but the value is very apparent. So just playing raise, like small raise, right. Even like,
well, yeah,
click, I mean, it, go 425 with the spade, jam without the spade.
I think that's fine. And I also think, like, It's an example of a spot where if you are up against bluffs, they are bluffs that have equity, right? Like, if you
flush draws.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's no flush draws. You're not running into any bluffs that you actively want them to be forced to continue with.
Like, you're not going
to
see like queen jack suited.
Exactly. Like, there's no, when you have kings in particular, there's no bluff in their range that you're like crushing, right? You're crushing some value, but they're not folding that value. And then if they have a bluff, they have equity against kings. So you probably just want to ship it on the flop.
I kind of like playing aggressive flop strategy where, like, if someone ever finds a way to fold the flush draw incorrectly, like, you're just stealing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, I like that as well. And then, like, because the way I've heard it described is, if you think about the EV that you gain, and for every dollar that you put in the pot, if your opponent continues with a hand that has 40% equity, every dollar that you put in the pot, you're winning 60% of that dollar. But if your opponent continues with a hand that has only 20% equity, you're winning 80% of that dollar. So almost in every spot, the majority of your EV is going to be contributed by the times that you get your opponent to continue with hands that are actually definitively worse, not hands that are just like live but drawing, right? So when you get your opponent to call with a flush draw here, or what, you get them to continue bluffing on the turn with a flush draw, you're benefiting some, but they're still very live, right? And in comparison to just getting it in on the flush draw, getting it in on the flop, you're probably not benefiting a lot. If they had some bluffs in their range here which were stone dead against kings, and you can get them to barrel the turn with queen jack of clubs, then yeah, absolutely just call. But that's probably pretty rare.
Yeah.
And in comparison to just being able to force them to get it in with tens, jacks, whatever spades they have, whatever other random hands that they might be leading the flop with, it just is very meaningful to be able to get stacks in on the flop. Yeah, here.
It's kind of a nice spot, I think, to jam, just because there are, call it, eight cards in the deck when they have tens and jacks that are really annoying, like a queen over card bad, probably going to play some check folds from them, or like ace really bad. So like, it's harder to get value from the hands that you very clearly beat.
Right.
And the bluffs don't really exist. So the reason you'd flat is to keep the stuff in, but it's not going to be there as often as other spots.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a nice spot, I think, to just
I think the reason why these flop strategies tend to play so passively is because they don't want the confirmation bias to come through of, I knew he had a set.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, they want the turn to be the seven of spades and then have it go check, check, and, you know, the river be a brick, and then have it go check, check, and they just win versus queens.
Yeah, I've invested enough money. Like, I've won enough here.
Right.
Versus
right.
I just very clearly win it all.
Yeah, they want the comfort. That's the irony, is like, if you think of that from a strategy standpoint, you're always paying off the sets because you have an overpair in a very low SPR.
Like, if a queen comes on the turn and he jams, you still call.
Yeah, you're just like always, you're always paying off the sets. So if you're always paying off the sets, but then you're winning the minimum every time that you have a pair of repaired, like, you're absolutely getting torched here.
Yeah. What it speaks to is the value of being greedy, right? Like, you have to take an approach where you want to make sure that when you have the best hand, you win the biggest pot that you can.
Right.
You don't want to just be satisfied like, oh, I'm okay with winning a medium-sized pot. Like, yeah. No, you want to win a big pot, you know?
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. There are times in strategy where portions of your range will think that way of, like, I don't want to bloat the pot anymore. But it's not because you don't want to earn more money. It's not because you don't want to put any more money in the pot,
or
in any,
like,
capacity.
The value is not valuable enough.
That's more of what it is. It's below the threshold of equity that can actually invest a lot more money into the pot, right? Like, you'll just have hands that are winning versus some portion of their range, but that portion folds if you bet. And there's just no real reason to deny equity to the portion of the range that is basically drawing dead versus you, while now giving up a bunch of EV versus the hands that are better than you that are calling.
Yeah, this is kind of the tough part for people to play against polar ranges, where when you're crushing the bluffs, but you're crushed by the value, and then you have like that weird in the middle spot of, oh, this guy 3-bet me from the big blind off this stack. I don't know what to do. I'm all in. And you just fold out all the bluffs that you dominate, and you get crushed by the overpairs that beat you.
Surprisingly, it happens a lot with Ace-King. Ace-King and Ace-Queen, I think, are hands that fall into this category pre-flop. Like, there are a lot of situations where it's justified to call in position with these hands because you keep the bluffs in that you absolutely dominate.
Right, and then when you flop an ace, like, they actually put more money in the pot.
Exactly, yeah.
It happens in cash all the time. You know, like, you open button and big blind 3-bets, you get to just call Ace-King a lot.
Should we take a look at what the straddle ranges pre look like, just so that we can see a little bit of what the approach looks like, and give a bit of an idea of what we're 3-betting in this spot, because I'd be pretty interested to see what kind of approach we have to take against Under the Gun here.
Yes, this is Under the Gun open. I mean,
this is eight-handed, six-handed?
Seven.
Seven, okay.
Uh,
Oh, wait, no, it's because that's
this the, is the under the gun straddle. So this is under the gun.
The one before that's labeled straddle, so it's
okay. Six, so it's, yeah, it's six-handed. Yeah, okay. It's six-handed. I don't think they have nine.
They have eight.
It's locked.
Let's look at eight.
It's locked for me. Why?
Oh, okay.
Give me.
I have the eight.
I have the eight. What the fuck's going on here?
They're dripping me out. They know I play MTT.
He's not studying. Wow,
brutal, bro.
Honestly, maybe I should. Some people in the studio sometimes put up the blind straddle on. Ren Lin said if Lewis puts on a straddle, he'll put on a double.
Mm. Maybe gotta get in there.
Okay. Undergun opens, cut off 3-bet, like we're playing no calls. And that's simply because the parameters weren't built for it.
Right.
And you're not gonna lose that much EV by playing 3-bet or fold anyways, because having capped ranges behind is kind of hard. But it looks like we're just 3-betting. You even get the fold. Yeah, it's pretty tight. You're just kind of very high at the top left, like suited broadways, good hands. Even H-Jack off folding from... This is from under the gun, cut off.
Low jack.
Wait, see what I'm saying?
Hijack cut off.
Oh, hijack cut off. Yeah,
right, because there's no low jack because there's the straddle.
Well, under the gun is low jack.
Well, under the gun would normally be low jack, but because there's three blinds, it's hijack.
Right.
What am I missing?
It's six-handed. Right, but...
No. You're looking at it in reverse. The under the gun one that you just pointed to is that's the under the gun that's the hijack response against the 3-bet.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, this not know how to read Wizard after all this time.
Yeah, like this is the hijack response after the 3-bet. Correct. So yeah, we're just 3-betting like pretty. Well, this is pretty linear, I imagine, right? Like this is just top left.
Yeah,
of the
it
grid,
seems you know? Like just linear, high card, heavy, like little bit of the Fantastic Four.
Yeah,
and that's about it.
And then Ace 4, Ace 5, King 9 suited, unblocking the offsuit tens. So yeah, this is kind of what the range looks like. And then small blind, like you can just send it in with kings. Like
send it.
Send it in with kings.
Yeah, you're just like like an ace can come.
Just yeet it in there.
Ace King off, Queen. Ace King off, kind of big one. Just like playing. Post is kind of weird at this SPR.
Ace King off loves
the thing
to
is like all of these cold 4-bets are hands that people would notoriously cold call anyway. Like it's not like the machine is saying fold the hands that you intuitively want to call.
Mm-hmm.
It's just saying don't fucking call them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, you have King Queen suited? Yeah. That's fine. 4-bet it.
What I think is interesting is if you look at some of the sims where they have the option in the tree to cold call. It's just that the sim doesn't take it. You can use the compare EV function to look at, like, if we did cold call, which hands would actually be losing the most or winning the most. And what you end up with is, if you look at all the hands that fold, the offsuit ace and king blockers and stuff like that, like, if you're going to be forced to play the hand, you want to cold 4-bet it and never call. But a lot of the middle suited stuff... like everything that's vaguely suited and connected and doesn't have an ace or a king in it, if you were forced to play the hand in some way, cold calling would be better than cold 4-betting.
So yeah, that makes sense.
You can look at some spots and actually compare, like if we were definitively saying I'm never going to want to fold this hand, you know, which hands prefer to cold call and which hands prefer to 4-bet, and we basically just want to be cold calling stuff that is not as easily dominated by the 3-betting range, which means it's going to be stuff that has middle cards, stuff that has lower cards even, and some pairs. So obviously that stuff is losing, but if we did cold call, we'd kind of want to have that type of range.
All right. So what I'm trying to do here, I'm just going to give a cutoff like the same range as like the theoretically correct straddle one, and then give the small blind the what we think a cold call range might look like.
Sure.
So it's like 8s plus, 8s to queens, some suited Broadway sometimes. I don't know if he folds them. Who knows, you know? So something like this, this seems reasonable because some of these, maybe they 4-bet. They feel like they're trying to make a move. Sometimes they don't want to make a move, you know?
Move.
Sometimes you got to make moves.
Got to make moves, man.
Make some money moves. so 9-6-3, right?
9-6-3, yep.
Yeah, that's right.
9-6-3, small blind. Yeah, they're not supposed to lead, which is not surprising to anybody because Cutoff has the better hands. Like, they have some good hands, but... Like, these hands are still worth a lot. Just because they're worth a lot doesn't mean you lead them.
Mm-hmm.
So, like...
They're worth less if you just fold out the cutoff's trash.
He goes, like, what? Like, 66 on the...
He went 200. Yeah, so 60. The old two-thirds pot lead.
Put the money in the middle. Put the money in the pot right now. Let's see. I just want to make it, like, look like somewhat... Okay, so like this range now, we see like a set is just gonna lead, queens are gonna lead, like
king queen,
ace king off with the spade is gonna lead sometimes. Like I guess we can.
Yeah, this is probably like not unreasonable.
Not unreasonable. Not unreasonable.
Landon brought it way down because he still doesn't think ace king leads. So now, now he has queens leading like 3% of the time just to bring ace king down to half.
Trying to sneak manipulate it so he's right.
It's like.
We caught him.
Yeah,
got him.
Like, what are we doing? They lead.
Your reactions to people playing hands bad are always entertaining.
And then you have kings, and you're just like, all right, like I can click it up here. I think click it up is nice.
Click it up. Just a little click back.
No surprise. It's calling the ones with spades and raising the ones without.
Because if they're bluffing with aces, with ace king with a spade, and you have a king of spades, it's more likely.
What are the in this spot, it's always interesting to see what the leading range is supposed to do after this, because you get to some weird spots.
After
where
call?
Well, no, after we, if we click it back or if we jam, because they're never...
Jacks have to fold.
Yeah, like they're supposed to do stuff that they're never going to do, right? They're
flush
supposed to like...
put it in, like yeah, seconds like, put it in.
They're supposed to find weird folds that they can't actually
sometimes
find.
Ace king just goes all in on you. They're like, oh, like you got king, queen of spades,
like,
right?
They're supposed to like lead eight. If they lead eights, they're supposed to like fold it to a click half the time. Like that's not happening.
Yeah, so it's like kind of who really knows. Anyways, we call turn was what? Five of spades?
Seven of spades.
Seven of spades.
And then he's like, oh, like I'm all in. Yeah, like that. The fear of like the jam is like when you put in this much money, you only get called by like flushes or hands that are good. Like so, like we just like click the button that doesn't exist. If kings with spades, you're like, oh, like we're just winning like seven bigs. Like,
the disdain in your voice is so totally funny. Awful. Every time someone takes like a punty line, the disdain that you have for it is always
how are
so
aces with the ace of spades ever mixing?
Because the issue is what's his bluff, right?
Who cares?
The machine cares.
I mean, you're just drawing to the nuts.
Yeah, but I guess the issue is you might see you set, but not really, you know? It doesn't matter. Any gem for 2x pot in this makeshift non-believe spot, because the SPR is actually going to be smaller than I put because someone cold called, so I kind of fucked up free. But long story short, hand too good. Queens, like, no spade, like, you're kind of, like, mad, but at the end of the day, I think that's kind of where the line is, but I would just raise flop to not have to deal with this, I imagine. Like, play the raise and... If you get cooler, you get cooler. That's where we're at.
I think that's where we're at.
Yeah, that's no real surprise.
Don't fold kings.
I don't think.
Fold kings.
But I will say, like, so, you know, why our users in the muck here is a lot of what I was trying to illuminate prior, which is how to navigate overpairs on dicey board textures where players are just too wide. And the fear tends to be that they
have it.
Well, they do have it when they put a lot of money in. Like, the guy still had it. He just had worse. Right? Like, that's kind of the fear, is that there's this convergence on all of their nothing just immediately surrendering. Right? So, like, if somehow...
Which is true.
Yeah, if somehow they peeled ace-jack of hearts there from the small blind, like, not only does he never lead, but he never puts a penny in the pot. Yeah.
It's check fold for sure.
What's really interesting about this whole hand is both players... The line that they took all the way through was fear-based.
Right.
Like, I mean, except for the 3-bet pre with kings, obviously fine.
Sure.
Call, it's fear-based because they don't want to 4-bet. They don't want to face a jam. They don't want to have to make a subsequent
decision.
Or even
just, like, only be up against kings and ace-king.
Right, right.
Whenever they get called.
They call, they go three ways to the flop. They lead the flop because there's two spades and they don't want to... They're afraid of seeing a third spade. They get called. The kings is only calling because they're afraid of running into a better hand. Then the turn comes to seven, queens jams because they're now afraid of seeing a fourth spade,
right?
Even though they were afraid of seeing a third spade.
And they have the queen of spades, so like the fear of it shouldn't
exactly,
even really be there.
I don't really know if they did. I put them to having it, but he just said they had queens, so I'm not 100% sure.
But it's like two fear-based lines, and it eventually ends up with them getting all in anyway. Mm-hmm. But they just were unhappy about it.
Right, and the fear still converges them on the exact portions of range that they were fearful of to begin with.
Yeah, and the result is exactly what it should have been if both players had played perfectly pre.
Right.
Which is funny.
Yeah. If you guys find yourself in the muck, please submit to our forum. Head to Discord, hashtag Discord in the chat, or at onlyfriends_pod. It's our pinned tweet. You can follow the link there. We got a lot going on in the Discord channel. We have a bi-weekly meetup every other Saturday led by the
one
Chi. He will be on the upcoming season, season 11 of Poker Out Loud. So you guys will get to see one of our students in the mix. Does a great job of organizing and running these biweekly study sessions. Also, we're getting a little thin on In the Mucks. You know, we're dipping into the multi-way ones now. We need more.
The mucks.
Give me more.
People in the muck.
More small stakes.
Tortoise
more
needs
mid-stakes.
More.
Tortoise.
And listen, one option is not an option, all right? Give me options.
Yeah. option. Tortoise is winning too much to be in the muck, so he's disqualified.
I know. He needs
someone else to come back. I think like we can kind of button this up with you know, the overarching discussion of multiway is so much more about how to navigate your marginal value and mm-hmm. how different that marginal value is quantified compared to whenever you're heads up.
Yeah.
Right? Like it almost goes up a level where like your top pair weak kickers is maybe where marginal value begins in a heads up pot, but now it becomes like your top pair good kickers. And I guess like what would be your general takeaway or your general advice to players who are just afraid of stacking off with this portion of range?
I would say just be extremely mindful of the SPR because that I think is the biggest thing that people struggle to adapt to.
Right.
And in this case, it's exactly the reason why the player ended up making a mistake, like not recognizing that SPR are three on the flop. Like you're going to have to get it in a lot. Like you're just, there's so many spots where SPR three, like the best play is being all in, realizing your equity. So I would just encourage people to recognize that when you get to the flop with those low SPRs, you have to be comfortable being all in at a pretty high frequency.
Right.
And it's really, really tough to be in a situation where something happens that causes you to make a big fold. But conversely, if you go to the flop with a high SPR and you know you're six ways at 300 bigs deep and the flop SPR is 15, now you have to be really, really cautious and you definitely have to make sure that you're not putting in tons of money with one pair.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
What are the thresholds for high SPR, low SPR, medium SPR?
I don't know if you can categorize it because it's like they're just numbers. So like what's the threshold for a high number? You know, like it's just.
Well, I think there's a general rule you can fall by. Mm-hmm. And that's when 3E is pot or greater.
Okay.
That's the way I tend to look at it. now, of course, this changes based off of the action that's taking place. But when we're talking multi-way, it's almost not going to matter, right? Mm-hmm. Like. If 3E is greater than 100% pot, whether it's a single raise pot, 3-bet pot, whatever, you're at a deep SPR.
Yeah.
Right? So let me pull up my little template. I got a little cheat sheet on my phone.
See, I know my 2Es pretty well, but I don't know my 3Es that well.
Same. Well, there's a little bit of a cheat for it. You can divide by 2 and bump back a stage and usually get the 3E.
Oh, okay.
So I think a good example of this is like, SPR 4, 2E is pot.
Yeah.
So 3E there would be at an SPR of, I think, 3.5 is half pot.
Oh, okay.
But let me double check that and tell you first. Yep. Okay. 3.5, 3E is 50%. At 4, it's 55%.
Okay.
So that's kind of like the little, it just like steps one, whatever. Yeah. It's a little convoluted what I just said, but you understand.
I kind of get it. That's interesting, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so when you're looking at 3E nearing pot, you're looking at an SPR of like 14.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be really high
SPR. I was going to say like 15 plus is like definitely where I would consider it to be like, this is really deep.
Yeah, and to give you another round number, at 10 SPR, 3E is 88%. So okay. That's also like,
starting to near, getting close to.
Basically, 10 SPR plus, we're starting to look at very difficult to be all in by the river.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Without like pretty strong calculations into your
bet size. We've been played out. I'm going to issue a correction to myself from earlier on.
Go ahead.
There's a reason I thought it was King of the Ring 1998 instead of Over the Edge. It's because King of the Ring 98 was the famous Hell in a Cell match, Undertaker and Mankind. Mm. Everyone knows that. Even people who don't know wrestling know that because there was a meme about it.
Right.
That's what I was thinking of.
Oh, is that where he comes out of the coffin?
Undertaker did that like 50 times.
Oh, that's like the meme.
It's when Mick Foley fell through the ceiling of the cage to the mat and like fucked himself up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, effectively they were both part of the undead.
Yes, Mick Foley has been for decades now. Like, I can't believe he's still alive. Yeah. Props to Mick Foley.
All right, that's going to do it for us today. We're going to be back tomorrow at noon Pacific. I believe we're going to get into this recent GG scandal. With I think it's called OK Poker, the Russian affiliate. The Russians. I'm going to dig into the homework for that tonight. So we're either going to get to that as the lead tomorrow or on Friday. I'm really unsure. But be sure to stay tuned. Noon Pacific, we'll be joined by Melissa Poo Dog Schubert in the building.
Will we, though?
Will we, though?
She might sleep there.
We'll see. We'll
sorry,
see
slept
though.
You alarm.
Peace.
See you.